I've selected a reading by my ministerial colleagues, Reverend John Burens and our own Reverend Rebecca Parker. This is from their recent book, A House for Hope. They write, "We humans are not so much Homo sapiens, for we are neither all that wise nor all that self-aware. Rather, we are the animal that makes promises." Martin Buber said this long ago. What is it that makes us human? We are the promise-making, promise-keeping, promise-breaking animal. We dwell in the context of relationships, commitments, and promises. We then either live in accord with them or we break them and modify them and renew them. It is our obligations and promises that define who we are. During the American and French Revolutions, three great ideals were united: liberty, equality, and community. But in the chaos after these revolutions, these three ideals lost track of each other. Liberty traveled westward by itself from Europe to North America. And left to itself, liberty's character changed. It became freedom without responsibility. It became freedom to exploit others and our planet, freedom from the obligations to community and the common good. While liberty migrated westward, equality set forth on its own eastward to Russia, China, and much of Asia. In the name of enforcing absolute equality, freedoms of worship, conscience, speech, and association were abolished. And then there was the third ideal: community, relationships, promises. What happened to community? It went underground and to hide, only to surface later on when people joined to oppose the distortions of freedom on the one hand or the perversions of equality on the other. Community emerged again during the civil rights movement, during the solidarity movement in Poland. Community arises whenever we break from the patterns that others have made and create new ways of being together based on the promises that we make to each other. In living within these promises, we have a difficult task of balancing and reconciling liberty, equality, and community. Thus ends the reading. In the foothills of the Zagros Mountains of Iran, amidst the ruins of the ancient city of Susa, French archaeologists in 1901 made an astounding discovery: a black rock monolith, 7.5 feet high, made of the igneous rock known as diorite. And at the top, there is a sculpture showing a Mesopotamian king receiving the insignia of his office from the sun god Shamash, the Mesopotamian god of justice. Inscribed below this sculptured relief is an extensive text of 282 laws, written in the cuneiform script known as Akkadian. The text celebrates the piety and justice of Hammurabi, king of Babylon in the 18th century BCE. The laws of King Hammurabi far predate the laws of the Hebrew Bible. The discovery of this monolith caused a sensation. The original now stands in the Louvre in Paris, and there's an exact replica at the Oriental Institute at Chicago. Many of you may have seen either of these. The laws on this monolith deal with day-to-day issues in the ancient Near East. The Code of Hammurabi includes offenses against justice, such as false accusation, offenses against property, land and dwelling places, trade and commerce, marriage, family, personal property, laws of agriculture, professional standards for laborers, and so forth. This code from long ago is an enduring reminder that as civilizations evolve from nomadic into settled communities, They made agreements and shared expectations for getting along. Fast forward to the present age. Southern California. 29 families' homes lie directly in the path of a raging wildfire driven by the Santa Ana winds. Temperatures in the fire exceed 2,000 degrees. There's no hope of saving any homes unless the homeowners quickly make fire breaks by disking up the ground around their homes with a tractor so that the dried grass can be turned over. But there's a small problem. Their homes lie within the habitat of the Stevens kangaroo rat, a protected species. The wildfire shows no respect for the rats. It burns the rats and their habitat. And as the windswept fire bears down on the homes, it becomes clear that saving the rats' habitat is far-fetched. However, local officials cannot make an exception to permit homeowners to turn up the soil to save their homes. After all, a right is a right. The law says nothing about wildfires. And so 28 of the 29 homes were incinerated. Michael Rowe, the owner of the 29th home, went ahead and plowed up his yard anyway. "How would it look," he asked, "if I get sent to Folsom Prison because I saved my house?" The next week, he found himself living in isolation in the one remaining home on a charred landscape, a torched reminder of unyielding rules. So what's going on? Instead of adaptive responses amidst life's slings and arrows, we're caught between two extremes. At one extreme, a burgeoning list of rights, entitlements, and freedoms. And at the other extreme, a burgeoning mound of codes, punitive sanctions, to constrain those very same freedoms. It was a century ago that the English judge, Lord John Fletcher Moulton, gave an address on the subject of law and manners. He divided human actions into three domains. One is the domain of law, where human actions are codified in laws, bylaws, contracts, where there is a punitive consequence for violation. At the other extreme is the domain of free choice and personal preference, embodying all those freedoms that are inherent in our humanity. And in between is the region that Lord Moulton identified as obedience to the unenforceable, Ubuntu, if you will. It's the domain of kindness, hospitality, manners, civility, passion, and compassion. A domain which, in this tweeting at the speed of light, a domain which seems to be being squeezed out somehow. What is happening to respect and civility? I want to offer a surmise. This isn't based on any hard data, but it is based on observations of congregations and a variety of human communities, families. I believe that the most telling indicator of health in any family system of any size is the breadth of this middle zone, the middle domain of unenforceable obligations and Ubuntu. How much of a group's time and energy is spent in this middle zone, where there is respect, civility, give and take, trial and error, forgiveness, try and again. In my experience, the congregations that are troubled get in trouble not because of cash flow or staffing or building needs or any other tangible measure. The trouble emerges when they feel squeezed out of options. The middle zone has become not a broad playing field, but a knife edge, a tight wire. And such squeezing happens when the advocates of more rules, more bylaws, more constraints, more policies are clawing their way in to try to get some hammers into this, while from the other direction, of course, advocates of unrestrained freedoms are defending their turf, leaving little room for conversation and the development of agility. We ministers get into this all the time, not only in our congregations, but in dealing with our colleagues. Oh my gosh. Oh my gosh. Once upon a time, there were four clergy, rabbi, priest, Methodist, and a Unitarian, often met to discuss the issues of the day. But regardless of the topic, three were always in agreement, whereas the fourth, the Unitarian, of course, had a contrary opinion. One day, Reverend Sally, the Unitarian, got fed up with hearing, "It's three against one," indicating, "Oh, I lost again." And so one day, amidst another argument, Reverend Sally appealed to a higher authority. "Oh God, or whoever might be listening out there," Sally says, "I know in my heart that I'm right. Please give me a sign to prove it." It was a beautiful sunny day. As soon as Reverend Sally finishes her appeal, a storm cloud moves across the sky, stops directly above the four of them. The cloud rumbles a little and then moves away. "There," shouts Sally, "it's a sign. See, I'm right." The others shrug, say, "Storm clouds pass all the time on hot days." Reverend Sally is not accustomed to praying, but she tries again. "I need a bigger sign to show that I'm right. Please, a bigger sign." And this time, four storm clouds appear. They crash, tore into each other to form one big cloud. A bolt of lightning hits a tree nearby. "I told you I was right," cries Reverend Sally. Her friends insist that what has happened can be explained by very natural causes. Sally is on the verge of praying for a very big sign. But just as she said, "Oh, whoever is listening," the sky turns black, the earth shakes, the wind howls, and a deep booming voice thunders, "She's right." Sally turns to the others and says, "Well now." "So," shrugs one of the others, "it's still three against two." Let's turn back the clock a year or so. You remember the transition team and I hosted a Saturday morning workshop, and one of the purposes was to consider different perspectives about belonging, about the spirit of community. What does it mean to belong, to be in relationship? And before we began, we suggested that provisionally we agree on some simple ground rules for the conversations that morning. And here's what our agreement sounded like. We gather to share our personal experiences of what belonging means. We will respect each person's perspectives and participate with presence, open minds, and open hearts. This is an open event. Come and go as you need. Take breaks as you need. Listen attentively and respect how the available time is being shared within your group. Participate as you're comfortable. Pass if you don't wish to speak. Silence is fine. Determine your own depth of trust and respect the decisions of others. Maintain confidences in your group. Assume personal responsibility by using I statements. And respond to others by sharing your own experiences, not by giving advice or arguing. Okay, that was our provisional agreement. There may have been a few other phrases. Question. So what? Here's the question. Would that sort of agreement be helpful? Would it constrain? Would it diminish your freedom? Or might it clarify and strengthen the quality of respect in the group? You know, the middle domain, it's kind of like a broad playing field. with clear boundaries of time and space. It has well-defined goals, measurable, sometimes with instant replay. And the activities on the field comply with agreed-upon rules. It's not a free-for-all. And you have rules so that nobody gets hurt. Skilled referees pay attention to compliance. And for egregious infractions, they impose mutually agreed upon timeouts, penalties. And within these agreed upon limits on a playing field, there is still enormous space for personal creativity and initiative. And when the game ends, there are handshakes, hugs, and celebrations. Gatorade showers. That's the middle domain. A broad playing field. Very broad playing field. There's one more aspect of how we walk together that I want to highlight before I close. And it's about how we share our dreams and inspire each other in these experiences of give and take in the middle zone. You know, often the way we teach dreams is with two-dimensional diagrams and flowcharts, and that's fine. Spreadsheets, timelines, and pie diagrams can be informative as a backdrop. But if you want to convey your hopes and passions and inspire these in others, you paint a picture imaginatively. If a picture is worth 1,000 words, then a dream is worth 1,000 pictures. Or you create a song, a poem, a work of art, which transforms the two-dimensional spreadsheets and task lists into a new kind of vitality. So what then might you put in the pictures you paint, and in the songs that you sing, and in the stories that you tell? Well, put some horizons in your pictures so that people have room to envision new landscapes. Put mountains in the picture so that they will understand that the journey may not always be easy going. It's going to take effort, time and sweat, maybe even some ice-ups. Put sun in your picture, representing warmth. As you pursue these dreams, there is something that warms your spirit, and it is the community around you. Put pathways in the picture. A yellow brick road, because that path gives direction and focus. It's no guarantee. This is the difference between hope and optimism that we heard from Jim Key a while ago. But put a path in the picture so that as people walk, they have a sense that they are moving together. How shall we walk? The key word is together. Put humor in the picture. Clowns with funny faces. Cows with knowing smiles. Even some bloated barnyard cats. Some ducks. And put flowers in your picture. Because for any dream that is worth pursuing, there are going to be times to stop and smell the flowers. Because the final destination isn't the key. Our dreams are great not because we shall arrive at them. Our dreams are great because of what it will help us to become. To dwell in the middle domain of civility and respect. So try putting down your tweets for a few moments and see if something in this middle domain can reemerge. We began with Stafford's ritual to read to each other, saying that if you don't know the kind of person I am, and if I don't know the kind of person you are, a pattern that others have made may prevail in the world. This is about agency. This is about reclaiming that which is mine. I'm not going to walk off stage, off my stage, and surrender to any bullying which would claim that space. I'm not going to walk away. I offer these words of Diane Ackerman in closing. This is about walking together in trust. In the name of the daybreak and the eyelids of morning and the wayfaring moon and the night when it departs, I swear I will not dishonor my soul with hatred, but I shall offer myself humbly as a guardian of nature, as a healer of misery, as a messenger of wonder, and as an architect of peace. In the name of the sun and its mirrors, and the day that embraces it, and the cloud veils drawn over it, and the uttermost night, and the male and the female, and the plants bursting with seeds, and the crowning seasons of the firefly and the apple, I will honor all of life, wherever and in whatever forms it may dwell. On this earth, my home, and in the mansions of the stars. May it be so.